Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm your marine science girl, Carly Weiner, and today we are going to be discussing important deep ocean research that has taken place over the last year and a half in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, or the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. Dr. Chris Kelly and Jonathan Tree from the University of Hawaii are here to share their experiences and findings working across the Hawaiian archipelago and examining areas that few people ever get to see. Chris and Jonathan have both been involved in the recent month-long expedition aboard NOAA's ocean exploration vessel, Okeanos, on the Hohonu Moana mission. We have a jam-packed show, so we're going to dive right in, no pun intended. First up, Dr. Chris Kelly. He was faculty in the Oceanography Department and has served as the program biologist for the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory, also known as HURL, for the last 15 years at the University of Hawaii. Chris, it's really nice to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoyed it the first time, and I think I'm going to enjoy it the second time, too.
Well, we hope so. And it's been a while since you were here last, so why don't you kind of give us a brief overview of what you've been up to in the past year?
Well, excuse me. After the Schmidt Ocean Institute project aboard the Falkor, which is the last time that we were here together, I've just been working on data and doing some contracts. I worked on an undersea munitions project outside of Pearl Harbor, and I did some deep coral database work in the wintertime, and then I got picked up by the Office of Ocean Exploration in February to work on this project, which we're going to talk about today.
Excellent. And I'm really excited to talk about the project that you've done in the past month. It seems like you've been able to do some amazing dives and find some really neat things.
Yes, we did. So we had an 18-dive program up in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. And then we just finished, as of yesterday, a 7-day program that we were working here in the main Hawaiian Islands and also down in the geologist seamounts. And both cruises were really, really exciting. The vehicle was cooperating, the weather was cooperating, everything was going well. So it came out as good or better than I had hoped for.
Well, it's always nice when everything kind of comes into place. And you talked about the vehicle and 18 dives. Let's talk more about that. And it was a remotely operated vehicle.
Yes. So what it is the ship is called the Okeanos Explorer, mm-hmm. operated by NOAA's Office of Ocean Exploration and Research. And they have a 6,000-meter capable remotely operated vehicle, or ROV, called the Deep Discoverer. And so it's the first time I've been involved in one of their projects. And it was really amazing. They have an amazing vehicle. The video is extraordinary. They have a full HD ProRes system camera on there where you can zoom in and just see extraordinary details of animals. They've rigged up the ROV, so they have this lighting system, which I've never even seen before on any vehicle, where they have the lights mounted on booms where they can actually get the lighting exactly the way they want it.
That's fantastic. Yep. So was there anything surprising in these dives that you found?
Pretty much everything.
So, well, first, let's, I guess, maybe just paint a picture for our listeners that, you know, never get to see or go down to some of these depths. What types of animals were you looking at? What's the lighting? I mean, 6,000 meters, were you diving that deep?
Well, we did a couple of deep dives, but most of them weren't quite that deep. We're mostly focusing around 2,000 meters, 2,500 meters. We did one to 4,800 meters, I believe. We were looking for high-density coral and sponge communities, and what I mean by that is we're looking for deep-water communities, mostly below 1,000 meters, which are going to be dominated by deep-water or cold-water corals, as well as glass sponges. And basically, you can find some corals and sponges everywhere on the seafloor, but we were looking specifically where they occur in huge abundances and for very large areas. So the way we described it is we're hunting for probably the most important types of habitats that are down there in deeper water. And we're looking for habitats that are miles in length and that the density exceeds 1 per meter squared of these animals.
And why look for those high density areas? Is that just more biodiversity, or why target that specific type of coral area?
Well, it's because there is an emerging industry that not that many people know about. It's the deep sea mining industry, and it is not occurring right now, but there are a lot of plans to to start the industry. There are some leases that are being provided now in international waters, but again, no one at the moment has actually started it, but it's coming, because we're going to run out of certain types of minerals and metals and terrestrial sources probably in the next 50, 100 years or so. The deep sea floor represents a huge reservoir of some of these things that we need in order to have cell phones and solar panels and wind turbines and things like this. So it's coming. What we want to do with the project is to get ahead of the game and actually start understanding what's down there at the depths where mining is going to occur. And also, if you were going to pick one type of habitat that you really want to be concerned about and perhaps protect in the future, it would be these very high-density communities that we're looking for.
Sure, that makes sense. And these deep coral communities that you're talking about, how do they differ from some of the shallow or coral communities that maybe our listeners are used to seeing when they're in the water on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. Well, one of the things is these corals live in very, very cold water. You know, something on the order of 2 degrees Celsius. So it's basically freezing water.
Wow.
It's completely dark. They are not photosynthetic corals like your shallow coral reef corals are. They depend on capturing either organic particles or some type of small prey in order to survive. Typically, they're oriented sideways because the currents are flowing more sideways than they are sort of up and down, where your shallow corals, because they're trying to expose surface to the sunlight, are oriented more up and down. A lot of them are what people consider soft corals or gorgonians. So it's that's some of the major differences.
Wow, I'm sure it just looks like a completely different world down there. Are the corals different colors that you're looking at when you do your dives, or what do they look like?
Well, they've got a bunch of different types of corals. So one of the dominant corals is bamboo coral. And it's in a family that's called Icidae, and there's a variety of different forms. These can be orange, these can be white or yellow. They can get to heights of, 2 to 3 meters. So they're really, really big fans. There are some species that have been used in the precious coral industry. And so they can occur in these huge forests. I think on another program, I refer to them as deep sea cities because the density is so high and these areas are so large that's how I think about them. You've got so many different types of animals, and in many cases, they're dominated by bamboos. Then you also have bubblegum corals down there. It's in the family Paragorgidae. It gets its name from having these sort of funny little bubblegum balls at the end of the branches, which aren't bubblegum, of course, but they look like it. And they can be beautiful ruby red. They can be purple. All different colors as well, and there's some others that are yellow and blues. So there's a lot of color down there.
Sounds beautiful. It's hard to imagine 2-degree water in Hawaii.
Yeah, it is.
Especially in this heat. Now, these corals, are any of them endemic, so found in Hawaii and nowhere else in the world, or are they found through deep oceans all across the Pacific?
Well, the tricky part about it is we don't get down into the deep ocean enough. So when we find something that we've never seen before, is it because it's endemic, or is it because we haven't been to enough spots and it actually exists all over the place? We just haven't been to the places it is. So we don't know that. So we don't really use the term endemic very much. What we do use a lot is new record for Hawaii, or a new species that hasn't been documented anywhere else.
Excellent. And was there any new species that you weren't expecting to see that you found when you were doing these deep dives?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm guessing by that response, more than one.
Yeah, we found a lot. We found a lot of new sponges. And I actually have been working, basically, there's one group that I've been working a lot on. It's the deepwater sponges in the last few years, at least. And I know every sponge that's ever been collected in Hawaii before. I have a whole list and catalog and know where they are. And I've been working with a guy in Vancouver, Dr. Henry Ricewig, who's the world's authority on these sponges. So if I don't know what it is, and I'm pretty sure it hasn't been documented in Hawaii before.
And you mentioned these glass sponges. That sounds intriguing. Tell me about that.
Well, they're called glass sponges because they have a translucent appearance. And that color, or that, I guess, the, I don't know if you call it glow, but that appearance is due to the fact that they have silica in their skeletons. And their skeleton is sort of a microscopic structure called a spicule. And in some cases, they're loose within the tissue, and we call those soft sponges. And then sometimes the spicules are glued together by more silica, if you will, and then it forms a rigid framework. But for the most part, they're either white or they're translucent, and occasionally yellow, but mostly white.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. That sounds intriguing. I'm definitely going to go look that up afterwards.
I love them. They can be huge. By the way, while we're out on the ship on the first cruise, I was with Dr. Daniel Wagner with the monument, and the two of us actually submitted a paper right there from the ship describing what we believe is the largest sponge ever documented in the world, and we found it up there on the first cruise.
Wow, and what kind of size are we talking about for the largest sponge?
Well, it's described by the ROV crew as being as big as a minivan. But we measured it out. We actually climbed up on top of the ROV. We didn't climb up on top, but we measured the top of the ROV. And then we used that from an overhead view to kind of get an idea of its width. And it was 3.5 meters wide. So you're talking over 10 feet wide.
Wow. I bet the excitement is just contagious when you're on board and you're seeing it for the first time. And you guys were live streaming a lot of this video footage so other people could see as well, right?
Yes, we had actually on the first cruise, there were over 500,000 views on the program. And we had a whole cadre of other participating scientists that were either participating through what they call exploration command centers, of which we have two now in Hawaii at the Inouye Center and also at the University of Hawaii. So we had scientists such as Jonathan Tree here, who was participating via the ECC is the way we call it. We had others from University of Louisiana at Lafayette, Florida State. We had a woman from the Shershov Institute of Oceanology in Moscow, who was actually working in the Smithsonian. She was participating. A woman from Japan who was participating. All over the world, we had people that were following in real time the program.
That just adds another layer of depth and excitement to it, really. I mean, you're sharing these findings in real time with people all across the world.
Yep, and so they were seeing it as we saw it. And most of the places we were on had never been dove on before. And so we were all seeing it at exactly the same moment. So there was a collective, very large number of eyes that were seeing these habitats for the first time.
I bet. And you mentioned trying to document these deep coral habitats before people go and mine the deep sea. But in the monument, that area is protected, correct? So
correct.
This would be something that you could use and extrapolate to other areas?
Yeah, it is. So basically, the monument is protected. There undoubtedly will not be any deep sea mining in the future there. But we're going to use what we found. The monument has manganese crusts, which is the type of deposits that the mining industry would be targeting.
Mm-hmm.
And we're using what we found in the monument as a proxy for areas outside the monument because that serves two purposes. Number one, we're actually informing the monument of their deep sea resources by diving within their boundaries. Number two is we're not revealing perhaps any sites that perhaps would be sensitive. And number three is that we're going to see similar types of communities in the monument as well as outside the monument. And so you can certainly make some inferences by what you find inside the monument to the outside.
And were you doing any dives in the main Hawaiian Islands or Johnston Atoll at all?
Yeah, so we were in the main Hawaiian Islands. We did some. These dives are all funded or contracted, if you will, by the Deep Sea Coral and Technology Program. Mm-hmm. It was just seven days, and we went and recovered some instruments on precious coral. That's in the 300 to 400 meter depth range, off of Oahu and also off of the Big Island. We did a study for Dr. Samuel Kong at the Hawaii Pacific University, who's got a really fascinating study, and I'll let him tell you about it at some point if you
we'll
want
to get him
show.
On the show.
So we did a dive supporting him, and then we did three dives in what's called the Geologist Seamounts. It's mm-hmm. a set of seamounts that's about 100 miles south of Honolulu, and there's been just a handful of dives down there, but we dove on three of those that have never been dove on before. So.
And what's the comparison like between the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands and main Hawaiian Islands? I mean, is it deep enough that there's no difference really, or there are observable differences?
Well, some things are similar and some things are different. So, you know, again, if we see some species in the main Hawaiian Islands that we didn't see in the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, is just because we kind of missed the spots in the Northwestern, or... You know, it's hard to say. The actual depths changed. We were diving mostly deep in the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Our first three dives, or actually four of the seven dives, were much shallower here in the main Hawaiian Islands. So that was a big difference.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, for those of us that don't do this on a day-to-day basis, to really understand what a feat that is to be able to go to these depths where there's a great amount of pressure, and to be able to collect this data is fantastic.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to have the ship, an OER interested in the Pacific, and have the ship out here for the next 3 years, because these types of facility, I guess you could call it facility, resources, whatever, they're not that common, and so we've got the ship here for 3 years, and we fully intend to make best use of it while it's out here.
Absolutely. So what happens once you collect the data, all that ROV video and stuff? What's next?
Well, I will very painfully and slowly go through and annotate all of that video over at least 6 months. I've got somebody who's going to help me out with some of the animals too, Virginia Moriwaki at the University of Hawaii. And the two of us are hopefully going to get it all done by spring. And then all of this data is going to get submitted to the Deep Sea Coral Program's national database and get ingested into this database, which, by the way, just went live, if you will, while we were out there.
Fantastic. Well, I want to hear more about the dives and deep corals. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk with Chris Kelly about the deep ocean. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal, and today we are talking about deep sea corals with Dr. Chris Kelly from the University of Hawaii. So Chris, before the break, you were talking about painfully looking at the video for many hours, trying to understand what is actually been recorded down there. You mentioned a database. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, the Deep Sea Coral and Technology Program, this is a NOAA program, mm-hmm. and it's headquarters in Silver Spring, Maryland. And basically, they have established a database that they're going to make public that has all of the deep sea coral information that's been collected in the U.S., it'd be the West Coast out in the Pacific territories, East Coast, the Atlantic, so forth, the Gulf. And they're actually funding part of this work that we're doing out here. And so what we're going to do is instead of just collecting video for nice pictures and nice video, we're going to use this as essentially a set of data that we have to go through and extract all the information that we possibly can from the video. And then all of this will be plotted out, the positions, what type of species were there, et cetera, et cetera. And then get that and make it available to scientists around the world. And hopefully this will sort of spread. I don't know of any other national database in any country that's similar to this. And hopefully it'll just start spreading so everybody around the world will start to understand these deep sea communities.
Sounds like a very useful tool. And when you're going through the videos, do you always know what species you're looking at, or do you ever get stumped? How do you do your identification process?
Well, if this was not broadcast via telepresence, that would be very, very difficult. But the fact of the matter is we had so many participating scientists on the cruise. There's actually a chat room that's live while the video is being broadcast, and scientists are actually putting in their IDs for animals in the chat room, and that becomes part of the log, the permanent log that accompanies the video.
Mm-hmm.
So when we actually start the annotation process, the first thing we're going to do is open up that event log and look at what everybody said everything was, and then that'll help guide us.
That's genius. Many hands make light work.
Yeah, and you get so many specialists there, and they're all participating, waiting for their animals to show up.
Right. Oh, so that's true. And you've done so much work, not just on this project, but lots of deep sea exploration and working all over. How does this project relate to some of the mapping work you did last year aboard RV Falkor?
Right. So what you're referring to is a project that a bunch of us got funded by the Schmidt Ocean Institute last spring. And this was to use the Falkor for 72 days, two cruises of 36 days up in the Papanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. We were able to map a rather extraordinary 127,000 square kilometers of seafloor up there, seeing some features for the very first time. And that mapping allowed us to actually proceed with this project because we dove on places that were mapped by the Falkor that we would not have dove on because there was just so little data. You can't pick a dive site unless you can actually see what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was crucial, the fact that the Falkor mapping took place in advance where we could actually get the data and look at it and then plan this whole cruise out. It was absolutely crucial.
So it truly is an interdisciplinary exploration when you think about it. There are so many intricacies and pieces that go into making the puzzle work between maps and the videos and participation and ID. What's it like to be part of the science community working on this? How does that feel to be on such a collaborative project?
Oh, I thoroughly enjoy it. I enjoyed the Falkor experience immensely. And we had geologists out there. We had a whole bunch of different people. We had people from Australia participating, graduate students. It was part of a class there at UH, a graduate level class as well. So this was a real treat on the Falkor. And then with this particular mission, the Okeanos Explorer mission, we had people from around the world, as I mentioned, collaborating. And we're just trying to, you know, essentially coordinate and sort of be a link between them and what else is going on the ship, and try to watch and see requests. If they want to zoom in on something which might help them with the identification, we would try to zoom in, and somebody would say, can we collect that? And we go, well, what does everybody think? You know, shall we grab this? We have two collections possible. And then we decide, and we'll get a sample.
So is there any spot that you dove on that was sort of your favorite and that you'd like to go back to again and do some more work on?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. There's a bunch of spots. I remember, there's a Pioneer Bank. There's a south ridge coming off a Pioneer Bank in the monument.
Mm-hmm.
So the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory had discovered a deep coral bed, and there Amy Bacco Taylor and Dr. John Smith of Hurl found this bed back in 2003. And then on this particular cruise, this is one of these spots which wasn't completely new. We dove below. We weren't diving where they dove, but we dove below deeper depths from them, and we found that the bed continued. And that bed, because we found essentially the high density where we found it, we knew where they had found it. Those two areas are separated by 6 kilometers. We don't know how far that bed goes. We don't know the upper end of it, and we don't know the lower end of it. All we know is that it's at least 6 kilometers long. And so I want to dive there and find out, is there an end to this? You know, how big is this community?
Sure. Well, maybe next time. It sounds like a really interesting place to go.
Yeah, it definitely is. You can barely set the vehicle down anywhere. The density of the corals and the sponges is so high that you have to be very, very careful maneuvering.
Absolutely. And I'm sure those are some skilled ROV operators that work very closely, carefully with the corals.
Yep.
And so outside the monument, you have done quite a bit of work in the past as well, not just on deep sea corals, but I was reading you had done some reviews for essential fish habitat designations. Tell me a little bit about that and maybe how you go from coral to fish, or is it all one for you?
It was actually fish to corals for me.
Oh, okay.
I used to be a fish guy. I used to work on the bottom fish fishery in Hawaii for 10 years. And as a result of that, then I got to know that particular fishery pretty well. And so I was asked to help out with reviewing and perhaps improving the essential fish habitat definitions for that fishery. And so it's different. Fish and corals are very, very different.
Yep.
I enjoyed them both. I enjoyed that work. And then I got just this itch to go deeper because that's about a 200 to 400 meter fishery.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to see what else is down there. And so I sort of moved into deep water corals and sponges.
So were you seeing any fish at the depths that you were diving on this past cruise?
Yes, we did. But there weren't a whole lot because one of the big differences between fish in shallow water and fish in deep water, fish in shallow water, like here in Hanoma Bay, for example, they like to be around hard substrate and corals, and they find hidey holes and so forth. So you see a lot of the reefs, there are a lot of fish associated with the reefs. Down there, it's different. You don't see so many fish where the corals are. The fish prefer to be out on softer sediments, which we weren't diving on.
Interesting.
So only saw a few fish now and then.
Excellent. And so the bottom fish work that you were doing before, was there a particular species you were working on, or what would you classify, I guess, as a bottom fish?
Well, some of the ones that you'd see in the restaurant menus, onaga, ehu, opakapaka, kalikali.
So the deep snappers.
The deep snappers, and then also the hapupu, the grouper.
Grouper. Mm-hmm. Okay, and working on that, do you ever go back to the bottom fish work now, or is it you've gone deeper and you're just going to keep going deeper and deeper?
Well, even though I sort of turned the page on the bottom fish work, I'm still asked to help out a bit with that, and I've been a co-author on a number of publications over the last few years, and so I enjoy it in that sense. And then somebody in the office is also annotating the bottom fish video, and they'll occasionally come in and ask for my opinion as to what type of fish they're looking at.
Sure. So. Well, it's nice to have a variety of communities to look at and different species. Earlier, before the commercial break, you talked about these manganese crusts that are potential for deep sea mining. Do you see unique communities in these areas?
Yeah, not so much the fish communities, but these are the mining, when it ever gets started on the crust, which I think will happen certainly within the next couple hundred years for sure. It may not occur, get started in our lifetimes, but it's going to happen. It's going to happen between about 1,000 and 2,500 meters depths, because that's where you get the sort of the richest, thickest crust out here in the Central Pacific. And so that's sort of was one of our target depths. That's one of the reasons why we spend a fair amount of time around 2,000 meters. And this is where we know for sure that there's some really rich communities down there that could potentially be at risk.
So we know it's hard to do video work at these depths with the ROVs because of the pressure. What about the mapping? Is that an easier process? Or what's the process to be able to map out these areas that you're working in as well?
Well, the process is you always want to map first and then put your vehicle down
afterward. Right, know where you're diving.
Yeah, know where you're going. So in one sense, the mapping is easier because it's a hull-mounted system and you basically have to just plan it out properly, and then you run your survey lines and then you process the data, and everything is done sort of, you know, without... The actual mapping systems are technically complex, but it's still simpler than actually putting a vehicle into an extreme high pressure environment like an ROV has to go. So in that sense, it's simpler. But the ROV, a lot of things can go wrong. You know, you're putting something in seawater and you're putting something in an environment that's thousands of pounds per square inch of pressure. And, one of the things that I was just amazed at is how few mechanical problems the Deep Discover ROV had, basically none. For
that's
two cruises.
Amazing.
So the guys who are operating the ROV, the whole team, is just so competent and so professional. It was just a pleasure working with them.
Well, that's great to hear. It seems like the deep sea is getting a lot more attention now in the research community, and more people are starting to focus and work on it in an area that typically hasn't gotten much attention. Do you think it's the technology that's driving the ability to better understand these areas, or just greater awareness that these areas exist and more interest?
I think it's both. I think the technology has been developed, such as, again, this ROV that we just were using, where you can see such beautiful imagery and you can go so deep with these, you can actually learn something about it. But also, I think people are becoming more aware of what's down in deep ocean. And it isn't just sort of an empty, barren space down there, that there's lots and lots of animals down there that thrive in that type of condition. And if you want to find new species right now easily, that's where you go. Because I think there's many, many, many new species awaiting discovery. I think there's some very, very large animals down there that no one has ever set eyes on before, and they're just sitting there waiting for somebody to come along.
And when I was reading your bio, I mean, you've been doing this work for some time now, working in the 80s in the hydro lab undersea habitat. In the time that you've been working, how has your work evolved or changed as the technology has developed?
In the hydro lab, we were scuba diving.
Okay.
And I don't really do that very much. It was saturation diving, and so it's a different type of technology. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to be, it's a little bit similar to tech diving, where there's certain things you have to be aware of if you're going to go deep for long periods of time. But again, we're talking about 50 to 100 feet, 150 feet, you know, for the hydrolab experience. And you are in the water in this particular case. You're not. One of the differences is that, you know, when you're just scuba diving, you see what your eyes see. I mean, your eyes can't magnify to, you know, super zoom, if you will. You know, that's perhaps one of the major differences with what I've noticed with this ROV. This ROV not only will show you what your eyes would see, you can see the whole colony of coral or sponges there, mm-hmm. but it'll zoom in on it, and you can actually see the microscopic parts of the polyps of the corals with this camera.
Wow.
And you can actually identify the animal based on the structure of the polyp on it.
Wow.
So that's a big
difference there. Well, maybe 50 years from now, someone will be sitting here talking about super zoom glasses for diving or something like that. But for now, that seems like a pretty amazing advancement.
Yeah, it is. It's just extraordinary how they've developed this type of capability.
So, I mean, with last year on Falkor, you said there were two 30-day cruises or something close to that. 36 mm-hmm. day cruises, and then again this summer. Spending so much time at sea, is there something that draws you to being out on the ocean, or does it become cumbersome after you've been at sea for a while?
Well, I mean, you always want to come home after you've been at sea for a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about 3 weeks in, most of the vegetables are starting to peter out down in the galley. You know, so you're seeing a lot more carbs and canned vegetables, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm a salad guy. I kind of miss that. Of course, you know, I'd like to see my wife and my cat, you know, these type of things.
Good you said that.
Yeah.
You got to after the salad.
That's right.
Well, I understand that too. And is there something that draws you? What's the most exciting thing, or what do you get most excited about when you go to sea?
Well, I like being on the water, and then I also just like to be there when things are happening, particularly when there's a deep sea project like this. There's something, even though you're not actually going down in a sub, for example, and doing it, mm-hmm. you're there, you're right there, and the instrument is going down right there on the back deck of your ship.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have not done the Exploration Command Center so far. I will be for this next cruise, the Johnson Atoll.
All right.
And I suspect that it's going to be quite similar experience. But, and so I have a feeling that I'll probably wind up going, well, I guess I can do the same thing from here.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you're not done yet. You have another cruise that you're going on.
Well, I'm not going on the cruise, but I'm participating via the telepresence.
Right, from the University of Hawaii.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. And so they'll be going out to Johnston Atoll. Will they be doing similar work over there?
Yes, they will.
Okay.
And that is going to be a really exciting program, by the way, because we just mapped it for the first time. This is the Okeanos Explorer, which mm-hmm. also has a mapping system. This is the first leg of our four cruise series. And we mapped to places that have never been mapped before, and we saw some really weird topography. And we've already are planning to dive on this topography.
Well, I'm going to hold the weird topography thought because I'm going to go to Jonathan on that one. But quickly, before we wrap up, if people want to see some of the dives that have been done or these upcoming work in Johnston Atoll, where can they go?
They can go and Google Okeanos Explorer, Okeanos Explorer. And I think it's just okeanosexplorer.com or OER.com.
Sure.
And they can watch the live feed. They can go in and find video and images and all types of stuff.
Fantastic. Well, Chris, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to go to topography and rocks when we talk to Jonathan.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. Today we are chatting about exploring the deep waters of the Hawaiian archipelago. With us now is Jonathan Tree, a graduate student in SOEST at the University of Hawaii. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Hi, Carly. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, we've heard a lot about these deep corals and some of the ROV dives. How did you get involved in all of this, and what's your role with the project?
I actually started out in the middle of the continent doing geology in Colorado. And so a lot of the marine geology has been new to me over the past 3 years. And I got involved first by going out to sea with Chris on the Schmidt Ocean Institute cruises on the Falkord, mapping for 72 days. And out there we found some very interesting features, some things that we chatted about on the ship and discussed different ideas of what it could be and how it would be neat to take some dives down there. And well, we got the opportunity this year to take some dives on some of these features in the deep. So we worked together to make some dive plans and places that we were both interested in that have the high density coral beds that he was talking about, but also have very interesting geological features that we could get two good things from one dive. So that was how I got involved with planning the dives, and then also working at the Exploration Command Center and trying to work with all the other biologists and chime in when I saw something neat geologically, and just try and annotate the video as from a geologist perspective.
So working in geology, how is that? And collaborating with biologists, is this the first time you've done that? And how does that work for you?
I actually used to be a biologist. Stolen by geology from biology by geology. And so when I was in Colorado, I worked in ecology and I counted butterflies up in the high mountain peaks of Colorado. I tracked foxes with radio telemetry. And so I've worked with and aside biologists for quite some time now.
So how did you go from butterflies and foxes to rocks in the deep Hawaiian waters?
It all started with an undergraduate class called Historical Geology that gives you the big earth perspective, the big picture, the fun really neat stories of putting together geology, and that's what got me started on geology. And I had an undergraduate project in Colorado working on volcanoes in Colorado, extinct ones, of course. And that kind of got me interested in volcanoes in Hawaii. And so I looked around for a graduate program and was fortunate enough to be accepted into University of Hawaii Geology and Geophysics Graduate Division, working on all of the Northwest Hawaiian Ridge volcanoes, so all the older Hawaiian volcanoes that formed in the past.
Well, it's definitely a good place to do that. I have to admit, I had never really had any geological interest before. After talking with Dr. Patty Fryer at the University of Hawaii, I have to say she sold me on rocks. She got me interested for sure.
Yeah, rocks always have a very hidden yet very interesting story.
Yeah. So let's talk about the seamounts of Hawaii, because that's really what you've been focusing on for these cruises.
Okay, yeah. So the seamounts of Hawaii, well, most of you are very familiar with the main Hawaiian islands, the ones that actually stick up above water and have beaches for you to lay on. But there's a whole new world and almost 90% of the volcano hiding beneath the ocean. And, well, the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, they've pretty much lost all of the island and are now only seamounts that are only shallow water sand spits and atolls now. So all of these islands formed 5 to 45 million years ago as the Pacific Plate moved over the Hawaiian hotspot, generating magmatism and feeding volcanic eruptions. And so they've formed in a linear volcanic chain, and it actually can get more complex than that, and we can address some of the complexities as we talk about some of the neat landforms later. But yeah, so that's the seamounts themselves, is the old 5 million year old plus volcanoes of Hawaii.
This has got to be interesting, almost like solving a mystery from many years ago, as you're diving on these seamounts and mapping them and trying to figure out the evolution of them, I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely very interesting. As Chris said, we mapped a lot of these seamounts on the Falkor cruises for the very first time, so we had an idea of what they kind of were look or where they would be due to satellite altimetry data. So we knew they were there, but we didn't quite know what they looked like. So then when we got to map them for the very first time, you're staring at the screen at a live plot of the bathymetry coming in complete amazement, looking at these complex ridges with cinder cones on them, or deep cut valleys with sediment chutes coming through them, and just lots of really cool features that going from land geology to marine geology, you can almost picture it in your mind what it must look like down there. And then you get to go dive on these sites and you get to work up an idea of, okay, so I am going to be diving on a rift zone ridge. I'm probably going to get to see some in-place eruptions. I might even get to see the vents that they came from. And that's some of the things that we got to look at on these ROV dives.
And you were telling me in past conversations, too, that sometimes what you expect to see isn't always what's there.
Yeah, so as a scientist, you go into a exploration project having a working hypothesis, what you want to see, what you think you're going to see, not necessarily what you want to see, but what you want to convince yourself of. And you end up diving on this feature and you are completely astonished to see the complete opposite, actually. So sometimes you dive on a ridge that you think is just simply a ridge that is formed because of erosional features, and all of a sudden you see that the ridge is formed from a volcanic eruption. Wow, I didn't expect that to happen. So there's times like that. There's times where you expect to see the landform look like something that resembles something on land you're using as a context for what you might see under the ocean. And you get down there, and again, it doesn't look anything like what you thought you would see on land, and it looks completely different.
And I think you were telling me the story, is it of Gardner Pinnacles, or Gardner, one of the seamounts that you were looking at?
Yeah, so I have one of my favorite seamounts in the Northwest Hawaiian Ridge. It's one of the largest seamounts out there. It's actually underwater, almost the same size as the island of Hawaii. And the island of Hawaii is formed by 5 or 6 actual individual volcanoes. And so we were actually taking a look at this feature when we were mapping it, and Gardner actually seems to be only composed of two volcanoes. So only two volcanoes that made an island the size of Hawaii in only a couple million years, maybe, where the island of Hawaii is made up of five individuals. It had to be some really big volcanoes.
I was going to say, so would you further investigate that to figure out why that was, or would you just say, okay, these are larger volcanoes, more powerful, and that's what the cause of that was?
Yeah, so we have different ways to make sure we know that there's only two volcanoes there. We have ways of peering into the subsurface using geophysics and guaranteeing, or maybe not guaranteeing ourselves that we know that there's two volcanoes, but making a strong argument that there are only two. And then we can start to take a look at the geochemistry of the rocks, and by knowing what kind of geochemistry we see and making some assumptions about where it came from and what materials melted to generate the chemistry, we can start to hypothesize whether or not it was a extremely hot duration of time in the Hawaiian hotspot that just happened to melt a lot more magma, or maybe the actual rocks that were melting were able to melt more than the average rocks that melted around Hawaii, and maybe there's a couple of other physical factors aside from temperature, like more of the material was actually coming up. And if you have more of the same material that normally melts, then you can melt more material again, forming larger volcanoes. So,
not just a simple answer. There are lots of options here to choose from. So I don't want to glaze over the importance in the characterization and how you do that. So you're saying rock samples. Well, are you using the ROV to get those samples? And what else do you do besides mapping to better characterize these areas?
When we first get these samples, we actually have had multiple expeditions over the 1970s and the 1980s up into the 2003 with some other ROV dives who have all collected samples. And so the first step in characterizing these seamounts is understanding what we already have and where do we need to go get more rocks. So we know what we've got and we know where we would like to go, or where we would actually like to go to get more of the same kind of samples. So that was our first step, is analyzing those rocks to see what we wanted and where to go. The second step was, where do we go to get something better? And now we have the opportunity with the ROV to collect two samples from every single ROV dive. So every single ROV dive that we go on, we can also pick up some geologic samples. And in the case of these previous dives, we actually were able to pick up samples from seamounts that have never had samples collected. And in a place where samples are few and far between, in such a complex area with a large amount of time in between, those samples will help fill the holes, so to speak.
So are you waiting at home with your biting your nails for those samples?
It'll be a while. They have to be post-processed by the Oregon State University first, and it will be a long and arduous process just to obtain a little bit of the sample. But yeah, you know, whoever gets them, if it's me, great. But I'm eager to see what comes of them, because I watched every single one of them get collected. I requested for all of them to be collected. So I hope that my choices will benefit either a younger grad student in the future or some neat, really neat science in the future.
That's amazing. So I also not only want to focus on the Gardner area, but another story that you told me about Bank 9. Yeah. And that came from some of the mapping work that Chris was talking about on Falkor last year. It's fascinating. Tell me a little bit about Bank 9.
Yeah, so Bank 9 is a very interesting feature that Chris and some of the others and I have written a short article up in EOS Transactions and AGU magazine. And so Bank 9 was never mapped. Well, it only had one transit line of bathymetry going over it, so a ship was actually not trying to map it. It just happened to transit over it. And that's all we really knew about how it looked. And then a group from Germany actually went out and collected a single rock from it, and they dated it, and it turned out to be about 90 million years old. Well, we expected if it's a Hawaiian seamount that it would only be about maybe in between 20 to 30 million years old. So all of a sudden Bank 9 is not a Hawaiian seamount anymore. And, well, the Hawaiian hotspot, what, just kind of stopped producing volcanism for this duration of time? That's a little bit odd. So we went out and we mapped it. And as the bathymetry started rolling in, I started noticing some very odd features. So we know that there are multiple Cretaceous seamounts, or these older 90-million-year-old seamounts, mixed in with all the other Hawaiian seamounts. And we can kind of see them. We know we've dated a couple of them. We know that they look a little bit different. And it just so happened that one of these Cretaceous seamounts was sitting right below one of the Hawaiian seamounts when it started erupting, or at least we think it has. And it looks like to me, based on looking at old paleo sea level and where the carbonate terrace is formed due to reef growth, that the Hawaiian seamount actually erupted on top of the older Cretaceous seamount. So this is another place where we went out and we dove on the suspected Hawaiian seamount, picked up a couple rocks that we're going to date just to make sure we know what we're talking about and confirm our suspicion that it is Hawaiian. And we dove on the other side where we know that it's been dated to be old, and we'd like to confirm the difference in the dates. So very interesting complex of features there. An old Hawaiian or an old Cretaceous seamount with a new Hawaiian just erupting right on top of it.
So this to me is really amazing, because you don't think there's such a rich history of development under the ocean. And I mean, we're talking 90 million years ago in terms of a time scale. That's incredible that you can get so much information from this area. How does that feel when you're making these discoveries or trying to put these pieces of the puzzle together and better understand our past?
Well, in this case, it was a great relief, actually, because the paper was just published saying that Bank 9 was an older seamount. And so when you finally see that for the very first time and you make that discovery and it all clicks in your head, you're like, oh, well, I don't think so, actually. And I think there's more to the story here. And it's not all perfectly outlined for us, and there's more things to know, and there's more things to discover. That's a great feeling, and especially when you're mapping these seamounts for the very first time and seeing all their features, it doesn't become research anymore. It becomes a passion, and you want to do a good job. You want to get the best data that you possibly can, because honestly, you would want to take the best photo of the best landscape that you possibly can, because you like the scenery. So
That's very good analogy. So last year when you were on the cruise there in person working, and then this year for the cruise, working from the command center remotely, how did that change the experience for you? And what was it like participating remotely from UH?
Participating remotely while you're doing it is almost no different than participating while you're on the ship. So you're glued to the screens in the command center. You would be glued to the screens on the ship. And so when you're actually there and working, it's all real time. And it's just like you're on the ship. But the only difference is, well, once the post-dive call is concluded, you turn around, you walk outside, and you walk home. And that's kind of a nice feature of being able to work on shore.
And better vegetables.
And better vegetables, yeah.
Excellent. Well, Jonathan, it's been so nice to talk to you about the history of the seamounts and really interesting geological history of Hawaii. I hope to learn a lot more from you and to learn a little bit more about these deep corals from Chris Kelly. I want to thank you both for being on the show today. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Kosi Island Earth. I'm Carly Weiner, live from the middle of the equatorial Pacific, saying get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.